I was a criminal defense lawyer for about 20 years, and I specialized in serious felony cases and murder cases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did that for a long time. I loved it and loved the courtroom, loved the challenge, but it was just time for something new. And I just didn't know what it was going to be because I didn't know anything else except the courtroom. And so I developed a hobby of cooking, grilling, making barbecued chicken and stuff like that. And then I started baking and making cupcakes. And I started making chocolate desserts. And all the while, I was literally committing to prayer that for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
That God would give me something else to do, and some other passion, some other inspiration. And I just didn't know when I was thinking about that it would take 5 years. But and so, you know, about 6 years ago, this just kind of came to me to make chocolate from scratch. I didn't know what that meant, though. I did not know that chocolate came from a bean. And then within a few months of that, I was down in the Amazon and trying to learn.
So that seems like a big jump, though. So from deciding to make chocolate from scratch, it's not exactly like making cupcakes from scratch. So you said you got on a plane and you went down to the Amazon. Had you already started trying to make, like experimenting with actually trying to make chocolate at that point? Or?
I'd experimented with it like a month before I left on my trip,
uh-huh.
My first trip. And then... So yeah, I had, but I didn't know, you know, what was interesting to me and what I was looking for was something to do with food and something that could be manufactured and something that could be made.
Right.
And then something that I could make with my hands. And, uh-huh. But I wasn't being really drawn to cupcakes or individual pieces like that. That just wasn't something that was, seemed to be tripping my trigger. So I went on this trip, and by that time, after I came back, I was making chocolate in really small batches in my law office kitchen, and my secretaries and paralegals were helping me, and I'd, you know, go to court, and I'd come back and make some chocolate. And then I knew pretty much by that time that I was going to quit law,
mm-hmm.
And so I started looking for a building that would be our factory,
right.
And I started buying equipment. And then I actually took on a partner who actually helped me transition my law practice, because you can't just turn out the lights. And I mean, I had clients and cases and court appearances, and she helped me transition out of that, which took about a year. And then I haven't had a jury trial in probably 5 years now.
Wow. I just have this image of your secretaries and paralegals helping you actually make the chocolate and... It's a huge, huge leap. So right from the beginning, I picked up on the fact that you said you wanted something that you could actually make with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just something that you wanted, something that was tactile and tangibly rewarding at the end of the day.
Right.
Right.
Right. I mean, I could cross-examine a police officer like nobody's business, and I would, I'm not saying I'd make him cry every time, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I was pretty good at it. And, but, you know, I wasn't making anything. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I was doing the right thing when I did this.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I couldn't. There wasn't anything to look at the end of the day.
Or smell or
smell.
Feel or...
Right.
Right. And yeah, so chocolate, I can completely understand that, because it is, it's all of those things. So when you decided to make chocolate, then how, at what point did you decide you were going to make it right from the bean to the bar? Was that...
I always decided that. I never, I was never interested in, I was more interested in the front end of the process, that is from the farmers,
uh-huh.
than I was in producing anything with the chocolate. For example, making filled candies or truffles or... It's not that I'm not interested,
mm-hmm.
Or wasn't. It's just that I was more interested in the front end.
In that raw material.
And so I never thought, it never even crossed my mind to not make it from the bean and to not be as closely involved as I could with the farmers. It was never not part of the plan.
So how did you make contact with your first farmer?
Well, the first group of farmers was pretty easy because Ecuador is where I went first, and it's where I traveled to the most, and so I had the most contacts there. And Ecuador is probably, if not the, one of the most sophisticated and mature fine cocoa markets in the world. So that was pretty easy. All the other ones have been massively difficult. And, you know, currently we source in Ecuador, Honduras, the Philippines, and Tanzania.
Right.
And we were the first ones to export cocoa beans from the Philippines in 30 years, first chocolate makers since their land reform.
Uh-huh.
That was hard. We're the first chocolate makers to deal directly with farmers in Tanzania. That was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Honduras is a little bit easier. But, you know, it's kind of like I use a lot of the things that I learned as a lawyer to find farmers because in most cases it's not as simple as Google. And in most cases, on average, and I've been able to shorten this a little bit, but for me to develop a new origin, from the moment it enters my little pea brain, mm-hmm. it takes about 2 years before I'm actually making chocolate from that origin. So it's a long process of finding farmers, finding
right.
the right farmers, finding farmers that can produce organic cocoa beans that I am satisfied with,
mm-hmm.
and then going there, meeting them, checking the place out, getting them back here by container, and making chocolate. And so...
Right, because
it's a long process.
Because you meet every farmer you're going to deal with. Is that right?
That's right. And I've never been any place. I mean, I've never made chocolate from any place that I haven't been. So I travel a lot.
Right.
And I've learned a lot over the years. And my focus with farmers now is a little bit different than it was in the beginning, at least in terms of how to get them to make what we want. And I would say this, that sourcing cocoa beans directly from farmers
mm-hmm.
the way that we do is the most professionally challenging thing I've done in 25 years. And that includes murder trials, which are very challenging.
Yeah, I would imagine. In terms of labor intensity.
It's not just labor intensity. It's the, you know... In my old days, a trial, you know, I'd prepare for a trial for a year, and then I would be over.
Right.
This is never over.
Well,
because I'm constantly needing more beans.
Right.
Because
so,
I make chocolate and people eat it. So, I mean,
yeah.
I need to replenish my inventories. And so just the moment that you think, oh, well, this is a nice little stable supply of cocoa beans I'm getting, then the floor falls out from under you and something has changed because, you know, we're very small and, you know, maybe a larger company will come and you know, there's many, many different complicated things that can happen.
Right.
And so it's never ending. It never stops. And you always have to be vigilant about the stability of the source of supply. And that's one of the reasons that I travel so much. And, of course, I profit share with the farmers, which helps, but it's not the silver bullet. And, you know, I work with them on how to develop, you know, better tasting cocoa beans.
Right. I did notice on your website, and certainly because one of the bars that I have is from Soconusco, Mexico, and I noticed that you actually don't deal with Mexico anymore. Noticed on your website what had happened there. So I was just trying to envision in my head what it must be like for you in terms of, as you say, you've got, you know, the farmers that you're dealing with, but I suppose even anything could happen in terms of if their crop fails or
yeah, that's the easy part.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, the part of a crop failing or a disease happening or something like that, that's easy compared to the other stuff that I have to deal with, which is just the basic things like fermenting, the number of days that they need to ferment and
right.
drying to the correct and proper moisture content in order for them to be shipped to me and not be full of mold. You know, that's hard. Getting them to, because it's a cash crop and farmers are paid when they're bagged up and weighed and they're paid when they're heavier, so there's a greater incentive to have bags of cocoa beans which have more water in them because they're going to be heavier, which is bad for me.
Right.
Because they're not dried where they need to be. Or last year about this time, a guy with a company called Armanjaro cornered a South African, cornered the world market on cocoa beans and bought like, I don't know, 250,000 metric tons or something unbelievable. Now, it was the second largest cocoa bean purchase in history, and, you know, things like that affect me.
Right.
Farmers stealing money from me affects me. Where I wire money to a farmer group, and then I don't ever see it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just a lot. It's a whole lot. And so I've just found that, you know, I need to be in front of them, you know, and I need to have constant contact. And I am in one way or another in contact with farmers everywhere, just every week.
So it's a lot of time away from home, and then when you come back, you're roasting and tasting. And so on that end of things, because these beans are coming from all these very, very specific places in the world, you're having to formulate new recipes all the time for them.
Well, you know, once we develop, you know, the recipe, of course, is pretty simple. We don't use any less than or vanilla or anything. So it's just, you know, beans and organic sugar. And so the, quote, recipe is really just a matter of how strong we're going to make it, you know, and what the cocoa content is going to be given that profile of the bean. And so once we've developed a profile for a bean from that origin, we pretty much stick to it, you know. So with roasting, that's our greatest chance to influence flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Once the farmer has fermented and dried the beans. So the three flavor points really are on the farmer, then us in the roasting room, and then thirdly the conch, and then by that there's nothing we can do after that. So those are the three flavor points for us. But once we're in the roasting room and we kind of are really able to tell what the flavor of just the bean by itself can be, then we start deciding about how much sugar we're going to add to it. And that's how we do it.
Okay. And now, onto the flavor of this white chocolate that I still, when I'm looking at it now sitting in front of me, doesn't look white to me, and I'm very appreciative of that. It actually reminds me of my mother's very Scottish, and she makes a thing called tablet, and it's like that warm sort of honey kind of taste. It's kind of like a spring day on the farm. But I noticed one of the predominant tastes that comes out, of course, is the goat's milk. Why did you decide to use goat's milk in the formulation?
There are a lot of great health benefits to goat's milk, and none of them were the reason that we used it. It was flavor. We tried many different forms of dairy, and we just all agreed that we liked the flavor combination of goat's milk. And you didn't directly ask this, but the reason that it's not white, the way you see most other white chocolates, is because we don't deodorize our cocoa butter.
I noticed that.
And that's a chemical process that I wouldn't even know how to do it. I mean, I know what it is, but I wouldn't even begin to know how to do it because it's done on an industrial scale.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the only small batch chocolate makers that I'm aware of, at least in the U.S., that makes white chocolate from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're pressing our cocoa butter, A, we don't deodorize it, but B, we have a press that was made for us to make the cocoa butter that isn't perfect. It's not an industrial-sized press, and when I say it's not perfect, what that means is there are some fines that get through the mesh that are really cocoa liquor that shouldn't be getting through the mesh. And so that's what gives it, it's not perfectly white, that combined with the fact that we don't deodorize. So it's sort of it's just a natural cocoa butter. And and then we combine it with the goat's milk powder and organic sugar. But it's a chocolate bar. That bar is a little more expensive because it's way more labor intensive to make the cocoa butter and then put it in the mélangeur to make the white chocolate.
And you're also not using any cocoa liquor in it, so it's got to be the cocoa butter that's there. It's got to be.
That's and it's single origin cocoa butter,
which you make yourself.
Yeah,
which nobody else does, right? Which interestingly enough, I mean, I think adds to the complexity of the taste, the little bits and pieces that you said it really is the most complex white chocolate I have ever tasted. And no, for that I'm grateful, because I'm not really a white chocolate lover. But
I wasn't either until I started making it. And it was really an afterthought. The reason we did it is because I wanted single origin cocoa butter to put back in my dark chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Not back, but to add more than what was naturally present. So, I mean, when I make chocolate and I'm adding sugar, let's say it's a 75% cocoa content. Well, of that 75%, maybe 1 or 2% is pure cocoa butter.
Mm-hmm.
That we add into to make it, to give it a creamier and smoother texture. Well, instead of buying it from ADM or Cargill or whatever, mm-hmm. I wanted to make our own.
Right. And
so that's how the whole thing started. And then after we started doing that, I was like, hey, let's try to make white chocolate. So.
And so every, if I've got this right, so every chocolate bar that you make, once you have created the cocoa liquor and the cocoa butter, it's not like you mix them up. Those single origin.
Correct.
They will only go together. The cocoa butter and the cocoa liquor will only ever go together.
When we're making a DeVal Philippine chocolate, dark chocolate bar, we only put DeVal Philippines cocoa butter in it.
Right, right. And DeVal the Philippines is where you've spent a great deal of time lately, is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And we just had an event in our factory last night for our Chocolate University program for our middle school students. They did a presentation that was open to the public about the Philippines and our sister school there that works with them, the middle school here.
Great.
And that was just last night.
Yeah. And so can you, Sean, just talk a little bit about the Chocolate University and how that came about? Was that always something that you envisioned when you started making chocolate, or was it just you know, how did that come about?
Well, it was from the very beginning, and the reason is because of where our factory is located, in sort of a part of town that's undergoing revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a part of town where there's a lot of social services
mm-hmm.
On our street, and we have two homeless shelters on our street
mm-hmm.
and other services available to people in poverty. And so I guess about a block from our factory is a homeless shelter with 80 kids a night in it. And so
that's the Missouri Hotel?
Yeah, Missouri Hotel. Mm-hmm. And it's it feeds the elementary, middle school, and high school in our neighborhood. And so we wanted to find a way to engage with the kids of the neighborhood, not just the kids that are in that shelter, but really more universally just the kids in this neighborhood. And so we started Chocolate University from the beginning. So mm-hmm. when the factory opened, we were doing Chocolate University in the elementary school, in the fourth and fifth grade, and we're, I guess, in our fourth or fifth year with that. And that is really where we're just involved in the units of study that they have in their school, and we go there, they come here, and so by the end of the year, they get to know us and feel like they're part of what we're doing, and know me by name, and I know them, and so that's a lot of fun, and it's no extra work for the teacher, and she likes it, because when they're talking about a particular unit of study, could be geography or inventions or whatever, then we just come and try to provide examples of those things, and then
right. So you just work with their curriculum, and they just implement
right.
it, so it really is applied learning.
Exactly, and those kids get hands-on experience with the chocolate here that no one else would get, no
uh-huh.
other people on any tours or anything like that. The kids get to get their hands in chocolate and make stuff. And so, and then the middle school program is more specifically designed to match up with what we're doing in the Philippines.
Uh-huh.
So anyone in middle school, 6th, 7th, or 8th grade, can be part of this. And it's kind of weird this year. It's all girls
uh-huh.
In this program. And they learn about the Philippines, and then they also correspond with students in our sister school there in Davao, and we gave them both flip cameras so they can share videos with each other. And I have been to the school in the Philippines, and I'm pretty much talking with the principal on a regular basis. And when I was there, I met with all the teachers and principal again. And so anyway, I'm pretty excited about that, because we're starting, and I'm knock on wood, but I think we're going to undertake a feeding program for the lunchtime in that school of 579 students there in Davao.
Wow.
And the exciting part for me is that it's not going to be a donation from Chocolate University to feed those kids,
mm-hmm.
many of whom are on a malnourished list. But what we're going to do is the PTA in that little school, I think, if they're going to well know in 2 weeks, they're going to make a little chocolate product called Tablia, which is a chocolate drink. It's just ground up cocoa liquor, and you mix it with hot water, and it's very traditional in
right.
Central and South America and in the Philippines. And so, anyway, they're going to make it. I'm going to buy it, put it on my container, and then I'm going to sell it, and all of the profit will fund the feeding program of a fortified soy rice meal that we're going to do. So I hope the kids, you know, can have some part in that and sort of see how, what an impact we'll have. And so then the high school program is one where I let them pick a country in Africa over a year and a half period that I met with them, where we were going to source our next source. And so they picked Tanzania.
Tanzania, right.
Yeah, and then we raised the money to bring the students and some teachers with me to Tanzania last August, and then we drilled a water well, raised money, and drilled a water well for the village there, and then we also created a sister school relationship with a school there of 1,100 students. And so we then raised the money after we got back to buy math, science, and English textbooks for that school. And this is a school of 1,100 kids with 9 teachers, no textbooks,
wow.
and no electricity. So it's really tough.
Uh-huh.
And so we built a library and had the books delivered in January, and it was real exciting. And so we'll do the same thing in summer of 2012. We raise all the money for that through our tours of our factory
right.
and then just private donations.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that. I thought that it sounds like a good deal. I think I might be inclined if I came to take the tour to, you know, donate a little more knowing where it's going. So
It all 100% of the tour money goes there, and then we have a fund at our local community foundation where people can make tax-free contributions. And it's because I could never raise $70,000 on, you know, $4 tours, but
no.
But there are some donors around the country that have seem to connect with this program that we have. And it's something that I could take adults on trips if I wanted to Cocoa Land, you know, I could do that, and I'm sure I could find people who would want to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, really, really important to me,
mm-hmm.
if I can, to connect young people to what's going on there, because
mm-hmm.
I think it will, they have so many years ahead of them to make
a difference.
Career decisions, educational decisions,
yeah.
that I might have a chance at a greater impact, I think. Maybe.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's an amazing legacy that, you know, you and your company are creating. And it's very impressive, Sean. I mean, even if it wasn't a good product, I'd still be inclined to. But it is. It's a fantastic product that you make as well, too.
Well, so. Thank you. And, you know, the thing is, too, I never it's always at the front of my mind that this chocolate has to taste great.
Mm.
You know, all of these programs wouldn't be possible if the chocolate didn't taste good.
No, of
I mean,
course
I
not.
Couldn't, you know, it just... So I'm always mindful of that, and I love, there's a quote about beer that I've transformed to chocolate that I love, and it's this, it's not about the chocolate, it's about the chocolate, and which is true, and it's so true for us, because the chocolate in many ways is a means to an end for me, and for our company,
mm-hmm.
and, but it's a great, great, great means. You know, I mean, it's just one that just keeps on giving because people love chocolate and they're interested in it. And it's just like, as you know from the work that you've done, I mean, there's no depth to the deep pool of chocolate. I mean, it just keeps on going. I'll never learn all there is to learn. I just won't.
No, there's quite an alchemy in it. And I think that, part of those dark mysteries is what's so fascinating about it. But, well, thank you so much for your time, Sean. I really appreciate this. And good luck with all these many, many ventures.
Well, thank you. And if you're ever this way, for whatever reason, I'm not sure why you'd be in Springfield, Missouri, but if you're this way, just drop in and we'd love to show you around.
Well, I think a tour to Askenozzi Chocolates might be reason enough.
Well, thank you, and have a great rest of the week.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.